Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
To defeat Nazi Germany in the Second World War, the United States made a strategic partnership with Stalin's Soviet Union. There was much for a constitutional democracy to despise about this murderous dictatorial regime, but at the time, the shared desire to vanquish Hitler's ambitions justified this making of strange bedfellows. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. To be sure, morally troublesome partnerships may be necessary to defend against existential threats. But my guest is concerned that U.S. leaders since World War II have engaged in numerous deals with corrupt dictatorships, not for survival, but for the sake of convenience, in many cases making it easier for the bad guys to do bad things to their own people. And he says we owe it to our own sense of self-worth to set the bar much higher than it has been. Ted Galen Carpenter is Senior Fellow for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. His new book is called Perilous Partners: The Benefits and Pitfalls of America's Alliances with Authoritarian Regimes. He'll speak tomorrow at 11:45 to the Collin County chapter of the World Affairs Council, tomorrow evening at 6:30 in Dallas. Both events are open to the public. Ted, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
If we decide to confine our global intervention strategies to what is essential, we have to define essential, right? There is a stark difference between what really matters and what would be nice.
That's one of the things that my co-author and I outline in the book. That when you're talking about vital interests, that is a very restrictive concept. It has to involve matters that are directly applicable to a country's survival as an independent state and also the survival of the freedom of the American people. We've had leaders over the past several decades that have lumped almost everything into the category of vital interests. Most matters that take place in the world are involving, at most, maybe secondary or peripheral interests, and many developments have no real bearing on America's interests.
And it's worth noting that presidents today have a lot more power than they did half a century ago.
Presidents have an enormous degree of power, including the power to take the country into war, contrary to the Constitution, which would seem to require a congressional declaration of war before committing large numbers of combat forces to any setting. And yet, really, since Harry Truman's so-called police action in Korea in 1950, presidents have routinely conducted wars without the authority of Congress and, in a few cases, over the express refusal of Congress to provide the necessary authority.
Who's influencing the calls with regard to what is essential? For example, I think everyone can agree that, you know, a partnership made to keep some other entity from wiping the United States off the map is going to be necessary regardless. But if it's a question of, you know, I've got a great deal trading wheat with a country that we don't get along with so well, it might be really important to me and not so important to other people.
That's exactly right. And most developments in the world are not really critical to the United States. I think one of the worst aspects of our partnerships with friendly dictators is that oftentimes it was just a matter of convenience. Particularly during the Cold War, our leaders tended to see every development everywhere in the world through the prism of the Cold War rivalry with the Soviet Union. So purely nationalist movements like the Vietnamese communist movement in the 1950s and 1960s, began to be viewed as nothing more than a pawn of the Soviet Union and Soviet expansionism. That's the kind of terrible mistake that we made. And the tendency also to see that the only options that existed in many circumstances was a choice between a friendly dictator and either chaos or a country sliding into the communist camp.
A lot of people today are drawing some parallels with regard to the Soviet Union's interventions in Syria.
Well, First of all, I would say Russia as a successor state.
Excuse me, Russia's Soviet Union then, Russia today.
Russia is still a conventional great power. This is not a malignantly expansionist totalitarian power the way the Soviet Union was. Putin's Russia is certainly authoritarian, but it operates very much like most great powers in history. And I can understand Russia's concern about what's going on in Syria. We have to remember that Syria is barely 500 miles away from the Russian border. And yet we regard Russian intervention there as illegitimate, even though Syria is 5,600 miles away from the east coast of the United States, but U.S. intervention supposedly is okay. Well, that's the kind of double standard that most other countries explicitly reject.
You argue, and this may comfort people, that the United States is incredibly secure for many, many reasons.
Yeah, the United States is the most secure great power in history. Not only do we have the advantages of geography, having two large oceans on each flank, and generally small and friendly countries throughout the rest of the hemisphere. So the notion of a large-scale conventional attack on the United States is the stuff of paranoid fantasy. Add to that a nuclear arsenal of several thousand nuclear weapons with sophisticated delivery systems that can put those weapons any place in the world. And add to that the largest, most impressive economy and a culture that appeals widespread around the world. Again, the United States can face threats like terrorism, but the notion of an existential threat, something that really jeopardizes the existence of this country or the liberties of the people, that is an extremely remote, extremely improbable situation.
Many people view terrorism as an existential threat to the United States.
Terrorism is and always has been the weapon of the weak. These are people who are out of power, who have no other ability to make their point except to try to strike fear in the hearts of people in their target country or countries. That's worrisome. But we have to remember, as terrible as September 11th was, and certainly the horrible, horrible day, nevertheless, you have 10 times as many people dying in auto accidents in the United States every single year as perished on 9/11. We haven't panicked and stopped driving. With terrorism, this is a nasty threat that's always out there, but it's a very limited threat. When I hear someone like Senator John McCain say that we're in the most dangerous world now than we have been since the end of World War II, that is utter nonsense. We face the Soviet Union with a 3-million-man army and armed with thousands of nuclear weapons and also having an ideology that had widespread appeal not only in the Third World but in Europe, in some of our major allies. To say that a few thousand fanatics constitute a danger comparable to, much less superior to, the danger that the Soviet Union posed is absurd.
You've noted that the terrorist attacks that have been attempted on U.S. targets since 9/11 have been smaller than 9/11.
9/11 was one of those perfect storms where al-Qaeda managed to do everything right, and the people and agencies in the United States that should have identified highly suspicious activity and neutralized that threat managed to do just about everything wrong. In addition, the attack itself, not only damaging the two World Trade Center towers, but bringing them down in a collapse, that exceeded even the wildest expectations of al-Qaeda planners. And so that's a terrible development. But unless terrorists could get their hands on a nuclear weapon or multiple nuclear weapons, they're not likely to have an attack that is comparable in size, much less larger, than what occurred on 9/11. And getting their hands on using and not being intercepted with regard to nuclear weapons is a threat that's out there, but experts have pointed out this is a highly unlikely threat that they could ever carry that out.
Do our unsavory partnerships today in regions of the world where terrorism is believed to originate help us, regardless of how great or small the threat, to combat terrorism and to keep Americans safe?
At best, those partnerships are mixed blessings. We have developed relations with authoritarian regimes that have gone after the same terrorists that we want to eliminate. However, many of those regimes also engage in policies that lead to tremendous public anger and to generating support for terrorism. U.S. alliances with those governments often do the same thing, that those populations are not just angry at their own dictatorships. They're angry at the United States for supporting those dictatorships. One could see this as far back as Iran in 1979, that the Islamic Revolution, and you had more than a million people in the streets of Tehran shortly after the overthrow of the Shah, our client for a quarter of a century, with people screaming, "Death to America." Now, when you get more than a million people doing that in one city, you might begin to conclude that perhaps you should reassess your country's policies. Maybe you're doing something wrong. But we haven't learned that. We're still backing things like the dictator of Egypt, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, and his brutal crackdown. We still are in bed with a Saudi royal family that is, with the exception of North Korea, perhaps the most brutal repressive government in the world. And yet we think the populations in those countries are not going to resent the United States. We need to rethink that position.
How friendly, and I don't mean this in a glib way, how friendly is a friendly dictator to the United States when we have made one of these unsavory partnerships?
Most of these so-called friendly dictators are terrific at manipulation. They lead U.S. leaders to believe that they, in fact, favor America's position much more than they do. They've learned that the way to get a tremendous amount of financial aid, to get arms for their military, their security forces, the way to do that is to portray oneself as totally committed to U.S. foreign policy, a great ally, and that the dictator's cause is the same cause that the U.S. is fighting for. That was certainly the case during the Cold War, and one sees similar signs of that in the War on Terror.
Shouldn't we understand this kind of manipulation and be able to see through it?
I would hope so, especially after about six decades of it. But the naivete is still there. I remember the second Republican presidential debate in this cycle and the praise that was heaped upon Egypt's dictator, el-Sisi, and the Saudi royal family as great friends of the United States, not just tactical partners, but good, good friends and allies.
My guest is Ted Galen Carpenter, Senior Fellow for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute and author of Perilous Partners, The Benefits and Pitfalls of America's Alliances with Authoritarian Regimes. You could be part of our conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Senior Fellow for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, Ted Galen Carpenter, author of Perilous Partners, The Benefits and Pitfalls of America's Alliances with Authoritarian Regimes. You can join this conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, so we have... maybe they're great relationships, maybe they are convenient relationships with countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia. If it's unrealistic, Ted, to expect all of our allies to be free of all corruption, right, and devoted to human rights, where should we draw the line?
That's an excellent question. And the short answer is there's a difference between garden variety corruption and murderous sociopathic behavior. And when you have a regime that routinely jails thousands or tens of thousands of political opponents or murders thousands of political opponents, that regime is in a different category than a government that is just corrupt and will occasionally put a high-profile political opponent in jail. So when we look at how our interests are at stake, we have to examine that. We have to examine just how serious a threat might be to those interests and how useful this potential ally is to dealing with that threat. And then the final category that we have to consider is just how bad is this potential ally. And the weaker the interest at stake, then the higher our standard ought to be in terms of which country were willing to engage in that kind of close relationship.
What do you know about how the relative weakness or strength of those relationships is presented, say, to the president in cabinet meetings? Because if you are in charge of this aspect of American foreign policy or American economic policy, things may matter more to you than they would to all the other people sitting around that table.
I think that's an excellent point. The danger I see is clientitis for any official, a particular relationship, or even worse, a particular personal relationship with the leader of another country can affect judgment with regard to the worthiness of that alliance. And we see that time and time again where, again, these leaders are not just regarded as useful, pragmatic partners for a limited purpose, but they're seen as dear friends of the United States. And I think a British statesman once noted that countries do not have friends, they have interests. And that's an admonition that we ought to keep in mind. Most of these partners, even when they might be necessary, are not friends and shouldn't be seen as friends.
To be clear, you are talking about really deep partnerships with states that we consider to be corrupt or autocratic or just dangerous to their own people. You're not talking about cutting diplomatic ties entirely, even to states that we find pretty reprehensible.
No. In fact, I would argue that one of the worst innovations in U.S. foreign policy was instituted by President Woodrow Wilson, where we started making moral judgments about governments, and that would determine whether we would recognize those governments diplomatically. Even if they controlled a country, we wouldn't necessarily recognize them if we thought that they were morally deficient. So the United States, for example, did not have diplomatic relations with China for three decades after the Communist Revolution. With regard to Vietnam, we refrained from diplomatic relations for more than two decades after the end of the Vietnam War. And of course, with Cuba, we had severed diplomatic relations, and we've just now restored diplomatic relations after more than half a century. Now, I don't like the governments in any of those countries, but they did control important states in the international system, and it didn't benefit us to refuse to recognize them, to refuse to deal with them. But there's a big difference between maintaining just an ordinary diplomatic relationship and crawling into bed with the governments of those countries. That's what I've objected to.
There are people very concerned about the Obama administration's push for a nuclear deal with Iran.
I've regarded the nuclear deal with Iran as the least objectionable, the least bad available option. I know the critics say that we ought to be pushing for a much better deal. Frankly, I was surprised that the Iranian government even agreed to these terms, because the agreement does restrict their nuclear program. And there are hardliners in Tehran that did not want any restrictions. But the notion that if we torpedo this agreement, that we will then somehow get a better agreement is delusional. What we will then face is the complete breakdown of dialogue. And then there's one of two options that will take place. One, either Iran can go ahead with its nuclear program and perhaps weaponize it without any restrictions, or, and the calls will rise in this country, for a preventive war to eliminate the Iranian nuclear program. And a war with Iran would make the war with Iraq look like a walk in the park. This would be much more dangerous, much more difficult for the United States.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also find us by sending email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone to Mike in Richardson. Hello, Mike.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, the question I had is, is the U.S., you know, foreign policy, is it actually naive when it comes to dealing with, you know, dictator allies, or is it just they're just choosing to look the other way, you know, due to the interest that they have with those countries?
That's a terrific question, and it's one thing my co-author and I grappled with a lot as we researched this topic. In most cases, it appeared that U.S. officials understood the deficiencies of their allies, but chose to paper over those deficiencies and portray the allies to the American people as something better than they actually were. In a few cases, U.S. officials seemed to succumb to their own propaganda. They actually began to believe that these people were something other than corrupt thugs. But in either case, we ended up with relationships that were not beneficial to the United States, the interests of this country in the long term, and really betrayed fundamental American values.
You have written that, you know, it's very clear when we really need a partnership because we're things are on the line, as we discussed earlier. Talk a little bit about things like economic relationships. I'm thinking of a country like China that has done many things that we disagree with. They really need the economic relationship with the United States to work, but we see them rather aggressively developing territorial claims to more and more of the South China Sea and the Pacific Ocean. These are things that the United States and its allies have a real problem with, but we can't necessarily afford to change the kind of relationship we have with China right now.
That's true of China. It's true of Russia as well. And one thing we have to realize is that major powers throughout history have had spheres of influence. That really hasn't changed. U.S. officials argue that that concept has no place in the 21st century. But again, you can see developments. Countries are going to be much more concerned about developments in their immediate neighborhood than they are about distant matters. I mentioned Russia with regard to Syria, and of course that applies, I think, to an even greater extent with regard to Russian policy in Crimea and in Ukraine. With China, the South China Sea is going to be a big issue, regardless of the nature of the government in Beijing. You could have Thomas Jefferson show up in Beijing as the head of a new government tomorrow, and they would still be pressing their claims to the South China Sea. And same thing with wanting to get Taiwan back. This is something that transcends ideology in China. Vast majority of Chinese favor the position adopted by the Chinese government.
Do we have a moral obligation to the people of Taiwan?
I don't think we have a moral obligation to put our security at risk to defend Taiwan. And unfortunately, as China grows stronger, the risks to the United States of maintaining that commitment grow higher and higher. Now, it's ironic, of course, that for a long time we defended Taiwan. We considered the government of Taiwan the legitimate government of all China, when that the facts simply didn't demonstrate that at all. But now Taiwan is a genuine democracy, so that injects another element. I'm fond of the Taiwanese. I've been there many times. In a perfect world, China would let Taiwan go, insist on certain safeguards, but allow the Taiwanese to be fully independent. We do not live in a perfect world. And unfortunately, China is not going to give up that claim. And it's going to be tougher and tougher and more dangerous for the United States to defend Taiwan in the future.
I don't want to get too sidetracked here on Taiwan, but can you explain why that relatively small piece of land is so important to China?
The Chinese believe that Taiwan was stolen from China by Japan during a war in 1895, that the United States interference prevented China from regaining Taiwan during the Civil War, where the communists triumphed on the mainland, and that Taiwan has no legitimate right to be independent. It is as much a part of China as, let's say, California would be part of the United States. And one thing I found out with Chinese, even people who don't like the communist policies of the government, don't like the dictatorship, when you bring up Taiwan, reason goes out the window. Emotion takes over. This is an emotional issue. They want Taiwan back.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone next to Thomas in Dallas. Hey, Thomas.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a quick question. So I don't know if I misunderstood your perspective in terms of if the United States is going to recognize the outcome of every election, regardless of who is going to come to power, like we had in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood, in West Bank, in the Palestinian administration, or do we have to disregard to the policies they have, not necessarily if they are going to be threat to the United States, but how they treat their people? I just want to hear your perspective. How do you think the United States should deal with those outcomes of different countries? I appreciate you.
Unless an election produces a government that poses a direct threat to the United States, it's our obligation to sometimes hold our noses and accept that result. And oftentimes our attempts to make a situation better result in matters getting worse. The obvious example recently of that was the overthrow of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Saddam was a brutal ruler, no question about it. On the other hand, he was very much a secular ruler. Women, for example, in Iraq had probably the best status of anywhere in the Arab world. Christians, as a religious minority, were fully tolerated in Saddam's Iraq. We managed to overthrow that system. And today, Christians are on the run. A third of them had already been displaced from their homes by the time George W. Bush left office. It's now over two-thirds. Women increasingly are having to go back under the veil as religious extremists have greater and greater influence on the Iraqi government. You know, I think we have to realize that sometimes our actions can make a bad situation even worse.
Let's imagine your perfect world again, Ted, and say that the United States had decided to prioritize its relationships according to what you've said. You know, make sure that they're essential, and if they're not essential, really hold the bar high for having true alliances with different states. What would the consequences be of changing the kinds of friendly relationships, for lack of a better word, that we have had with unsavory regimes?
It's always unpredictable what would happen when you dramatically change key circumstances. But given the proliferation of regimes that brutalized their people, looted their people, under the sponsorship of the United States, funded and equipped by the United States in many cases, it's hard to imagine a situation that would be much worse. For instance, one of the things the United States did in 1953 was join with British intelligence, our CIA plus British intelligence, to overthrow the democratically elected government of Iran. We put the Shah back in power as an unrestricted monarch. He was a loyal ally of the United States for a quarter of a century. But his policies also created the conditions and paved the way for the extremist Islamic revolution. That was a relationship that turned out very badly in the end for the Iranian people and for U.S. interests. I think we would have been far better off accepting the democratic government in Iran. And in most cases, even though we may end up occasionally with the election of hostile governments, we're still better off standing on principle and not betraying our principles to support short-term gains by backing authoritarian clients.
Was there sufficient evidence available to American operatives and policymakers to have predicted what happened in Iran?
There were CIA operatives that were sending reports as early as 1977 that the Shah's hold on power was slipping. Most of those reports ended up in the file drawers and never got up to the highest levels of government. Our White House and State Department were both caught blindsided by that. They still worried about a communist takeover of Iran, even as the religious forces were the ones that were dominant in the upcoming revolution.
We're speaking this hour with Ted Galen Carpenter, Senior Fellow for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute and co-author, along with Malu Innocent, of Perilous Partners, The Benefits and Pitfalls of America's Alliances with Authoritarian Regimes. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Ted Galen Carpenter, Senior Fellow for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. His new book is called Perilous Partners, The Benefits and Pitfalls of America's Alliances with Authoritarian Regimes. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we find Mark on the line in Dallas. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a quick question and an observation. One, I would be really interested in hearing what someone who actually works in the field in government would define as U.S. national interests, what the working definition is. To the average guy like me, it just seems like, wherever we feel like sending either military weapons or, bombing. And it seems that your guest has been speaking in the past tense about these sort of relationships we had with horrible countries, but they're conspicuous by its absences. Saudi Arabia, I mean, those people publicly behead hundreds of their citizens for witchcraft, but we can't lavish them with enough military hardware, it seems.
As a matter of fact, we have not one but two chapters on the relationship with Saudi Arabia, one dealing with the Cold War period and one since 9/11. And we're extremely critical of the relationship with Saudi Arabia. And you're absolutely right. I mean, our media have focused attention on ISIS, justifiably so, as a barbaric movement. And one of the things that we cite as evidence of this barbarism is the beheading of opponents. And yet the Saudi government this past year beheaded 83 people. It's on pace for about 120 this year. And although the Saudi government likes to contend the victims are all terrorists or drug traffickers or what have you, interestingly enough, two of the people who are now under sentence, in one case for beheading, in one case for beheading after crucifixion, talk about barbarism, they committed the terrible, terrible crime of participating in pro-democracy demonstrations during the Arab Awakening in the spring of 2011. One of those individuals was 16 years old at the time. He is about to be beheaded for that terrible action, daring to defy the Saudi government. That's our wonderful ally and friend. We argue that the United States doesn't need a friend like that, and it shouldn't want to have a friend like that.
What do you make of many people's contention that we have a friend like that because our friend has a lot of oil?
I think that's a factor. I don't want to overrate that factor, but U.S. policymakers for several decades have overrated the, quote, oil weapon, the fear that some adversary will cut off oil from the Middle East. The reality is economic incentives pretty well preclude that. Most of these countries derive the vast majority of their revenues for government operations, in some cases, all of their revenues for government operations from oil sales. If those sales disappeared, those governments would be bankrupt in a very short period of time. They're not going to commit economic suicide. And in addition, oil supplies have become much more diversified around the world than they have been in the past. Whatever validity that oil weapon argument may have had in the past, and I think it had very little, it has almost no validity today.
What about the idea that if anyone's going to have a close relationship with these countries, better us than, say, the Chinese?
In most cases, these countries are simply going to operate according to their own conceptions of their strategic and economic interests. China has already acquired some influence in Middle Eastern countries, for example, and in Latin America. But that doesn't really pose a grave threat to the United States unless China would, let's say, develop a close relationship with Venezuela and put offensive missiles in there, which would pose a threat to the United States. But short of that, we shouldn't be that concerned if Beijing wants to develop relations with various countries around the world. That might not be to our benefit, but it doesn't pose a serious threat to us either.
Does this deal-making, friendship brokering tend to wax and wane from one administration to the next, or have they pretty consistently maintained and cultivated these alliances that are troubling?
It's been pretty consistent throughout the period since the end of World War II. The justifications have changed somewhat. For instance, you get an assertion during the administration of President Jimmy Carter that moral values were very important to the United States. And Carter did distance the United States from some authoritarian relationships, but not all. For instance, we maintained a very, very close relationship with a military dictatorship in South Korea because that was regarded as an essential strategic asset for the United States. So much so that when an interim Democratic government took over in 1980 and a new military leader moved to take control to overthrow that Democratic government, the commander of U.S. forces in South Korea said, you know, the Koreans are very much like lemmings. They need a strong leader. You can imagine.
Like they can't handle democracy.
Exactly. And this was at a time when South Korea already had a vibrant economy, a well-educated public. Whatever excuse we had for supporting an authoritarian ally in the past, had really evaporated, and yet clearly we preferred a more predictable autocrat as an ally than the messy, somewhat unpredictable nature of a new democracy in South Korea. The amazing thing is that we didn't get more blowback, more resentment from the South Korean people when the autocratic system was finally replaced at the end of the 1980s.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Mark on the line in Alvarado. Hi, Mark.
Yes.
Hi, go Hello. Right ahead.
I have a question about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and I wonder if your guests would comment on it.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a new free trade agreement binding the United States and a good many trading partners in the Pacific Basin. The interesting thing about that is I think on balance, economically, it creates benefits for all concerned. However, the United States very carefully excluded China from this agreement. And that is causing some problems. Beijing is already really suspicious that the United States has adopted a de facto hostile containment policy directed against China. They interpret our actions, for example, in the South China Sea as really being directed against China. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership they see as another manifestation of that, that we're trying to exclude China from an enlarging economic bloc that the United States will dominate. And there's a lot of resentment because of that. I think we ought to make moves to try to include China as soon as possible. That would overcome that principal objection to the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
We haven't really talked about Pakistan this hour, and although I don't think anyone would stand up on a stage and call them an excellent friend to the United States, we have had some troubling dealings with them over time that have had significant consequences.
The Pakistani government has managed to play both sides of the street constantly. They profess to be our allies against Al-Qaeda, against the Taliban in Afghanistan, and yet you have elements of Pakistani security services, especially the Interagency Intelligence Directorate, that has openly sympathized with the Taliban, has aided the Taliban, some evidence that they even helped bin Laden escape and some of his colleagues escape when the U.S. was bearing down on him in the fall of 2001. So Pakistan is at best an untrustworthy ally and at worst a major part of the problem. So this is not one of the more productive relationships that we've had over the decades.
Let's go back to the phones. This time we have Phil on the line in Cedar Hill. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Who is the real beneficiary of our government when we deal with people like Saudi Arabia, and then previously in history, the Shah of Iran, and then just currently right now, Pakistan? Who's the real beneficiary, and what's the real benefits?
There are a number of beneficiaries. We certainly talked about the oil industry, and you find oil lobbyists who really want a close relationship with Saudi Arabia, for example, and some of the other autocratic oil producers in the Middle East. Defense industry companies, the Shah of Iran was a great customer for arms sales from the United States. One finds that the same with Saudi Arabia and Egypt today. So there are certain interests in the United States that may benefit from these relationships, even if the national interest does not necessarily benefit.
How do we achieve what you call ethical pragmatism in our decisions regarding international alliances and interventions?
First realization ought to be that when we really compromise our principles, it needs to be the great exception, not the rule of our foreign policy. It has to be a situation where a crucial interest is at stake. There is a very serious threat to that interest. An autocratic ally is not just relevant, but really essential to help deal with that threat. and there are no realistic alternatives to a partnership with that autocratic ally.
So we want, you know, a good reputation in the world. We care about our own ethical self-concept. How do we balance those two things? And is it possible to have both of those things benefit as we make individual decisions on the kinds of relationships we'll have throughout the world?
Well, I think Thomas Jefferson actually had it basically right two centuries ago when he said that the goal of the United States should be peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none. That ought to be the guiding principle. Occasionally, we might have to violate that principle. But again, that needs to be rare, not the general rule of our foreign policy, which I think, unfortunately, over the last several decades is what it has become. Most of the time, we should be able to protect our basic interests and preserve our basic values. They should not be in conflict. They tend to be in conflict when we contend that we have interests in an area that we could very easily avoid or minimize, and yet we think this is really essential to us, and therefore any partnership with any potential ally is justified.
So it's still violating our basic values to say, really want an airstrip in a particular country whose, you know, behavior toward its own citizens is horrible. Even though we're not doing that act, the fact that we are giving them any kind of support is a de facto endorsement of that behavior.
When we fund those governments and when we equip or train their security forces, we're going to be identified quite justifiably as being responsible for the behavior of that government. One of the things that was so striking was during the Arab Spring and the demonstrations that took place in Egypt in Tahrir Square. And the Mubarak, the government of Hosni Mubarak, who had ruled that country for three decades and looted it to the tune of billions of dollars, sent his security forces to try to intimidate the demonstrators. One of the ways they did so was flying over the demonstrations in helicopters. Those helicopters were U.S.-made Apache helicopters. Do we think the Egyptian people didn't notice that, that they didn't realize that Mubarak had been a close friend and client of the United States for better than three decades? They did realize it. And again, the resentment is percolating in that country and a good many others.
Ted Galen Carpenter is Senior Fellow for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. His new book, written with co-author Malu Innocent, is called Perilous Partners: The Benefits and Pitfalls of America's Alliances with Authoritarian Regimes. Ted will speak tomorrow at 11:45 to the Collin County Chapter of the World Affairs Council, and tomorrow night at 6:30 in Dallas. Both events are open to the public. Ted, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Braylon Becton. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.